Thank you. Well, I've been looking forward to coming here to speak with you, and I'm doing a number of things rather differently than I usually do, which is probably a mistake, but apart from coming to a place with new people and unfamiliar circumstances, I usually find myself preparing remarks where without any notes, but this time I somehow wrote everything down in a narrative format, and so I'm probably going to be reading and hopefully digressing as I go along. Anyway, what I found interesting about the prospect of this experience was to meet and speak with people who, whose, you know, experience and history is different from mine, and I actually don't know very much about how things are done at this group or the other groups affiliated with Insight Meditation Society. And I don't know much about the community life, so I thought in a way this would be both an opportunity for me, and it has turned out to be an opportunity for me to reflect on my own history, at the same time kind of looking at what I do know about the mindfulness practices that are, as I understand it, presented here most commonly. I am familiar with most of the basic concepts of mindfulness that are common to all Buddhist traditions and that emphasize meditation. And I don't really intend here to come here and engage in comparisons between different Buddhist lineages and traditions, but I wanted to share one story I recently had. I sit weekly with a friend of mine up the street who's in a wheelchair, so I go to her house and we sit together. And one week she suggested we start watching a video of Jack Kornfeld. He was going to present his basic teachings, and probably some of you have seen this video. And we did over a period of weeks, and I was really impressed with the way Jack presented teachings about meditation, in that he did so in a way which was completely within our sort of modern American vernacular for discussing inner experience, and without using any recognizable Buddhist terminology. And so it was very accessible, and at the same time, I recognized that he presented all the traditional Buddhist teachings about meditation and so on, without missing a single beat. And this, to me, was another experience of sort of getting to see how varied and subtle Buddhist teachings are. The first time I got a sense of this was when, some years ago, studying just early Buddhist scholastic traditions, which kind of attempt to describe experience, you know, in a very detailed way, and kind of, in a sense, opened up my eyes to what I was doing in my own meditation practice in a very different way. My own experience of meditation is really chiefly informed by Soto Zen. And I think what's kind of wonderful about being in the Bay Area as a Buddhist is that you actually have contact with lots of different traditions, and they all kind of inform each other and change each other in this very subtle way. Not in a way in which there's a sort of comparative, not in the way in which you compare things, like this is like this over here, and this is, I mean, we do this all the time. We compare, we have experience over here, and we compare it, or we read about Zen or we read about Tibetan Buddhism and we find parallels and comparisons. But in fact, I think they inform each other in a much more creative way in that people have actual experiences or they read a teaching and have some experience in another tradition and some creative impulse arises which transforms what they're doing. And so I think we're all waiting to see what will happen in the next few years, decades, centuries. But what occurred to me is a common thread through all traditions that I've been exposed to is this kind of willingness and an intent to move towards and experience intimacy. So in my own experience of Soto Zen, as I understand it here in the Bay Area, which is, of course, probably unrecognizable to traditionally trained practitioners from Japan or elsewhere, is that there's this emphasis on what we call formless practice. In other words, we sit without doing anything, without considering themes, or you know, there's no particular internal practices that are emphasized. It's just you, just paying attention, and really not much else. Really keeping it simple, and of course, this raises some real obvious questions, like you know, one is. You know, if this is intentional, well then, what's intended here? You know, there's something going on if you're just intending to do this and sit down and do this without any, with an attempt really to let go of doing things, of a program of any sort. And of course, the other question is, you know, if you've ever been to the Zen Center, which I'm sure some of you have. You know, there's all this bowing and chanting and people wearing clothes, you know, funny clothes. And so where's all the formless practice, you know? People are doing all this stuff, you know. And so, as to the first point, the metaphors of Zen practice often seem somewhat severe. You know, there's... sitting facing the wall and metaphors like mosquito biting an iron bowl and really the intent here is to point to kind of a non-mediated experience. The emphasis is on the idea is kind of a direct experience without second guessing what's going on for you, and not thinking about what's going on as a kind of strategy for how to deal with your experience, is to simply be awake within that experience, whatever it happens to be. And so, in terms of an intentional meditation practice, you know, the idea is to just proceed without distraction or digression. And of course, then what of all the digression and distraction, which seems to be what our lives are made up with, and the response is that's you know, we proceed from wherever we happen to be at that particular moment. And if there is a problem, an obstruction, distraction, fear, obsession, then that and that particular moment, being awake for that, is your path of meditation at that time. Just being within that. So this is, you know, can be described very simply as I've just done, but of course it's not, can't be really put into practice simplistically because our situation is constantly changing. You know, we may find ourselves able to sit with our feelings of fear or sleepiness or whatever when we're here in our meditation room. We go outside and get into our car and start thinking about what our children are doing. And suddenly we have a new situation. And how are we awake for that? And then the next thing when we, you know, someone honks us in our car and so on and so forth, or the phone rings. It's a constant dance of just to be awake in the circumstance that arises from moment to moment. So I want to talk a little bit more about, I guess, the concept of form, or, and I want to use an example. I want to tell you how I find myself in this particular gesture that we use a lot at Zen Center. It's in Japanese, it's called gassho. And, you know, I think Buddhist traditions that come here from Asia, you know, that have come here where the teacher comes from Asia and comes here and starts to work with people, it comes out a little differently than traditions where people go to some other country and then come back here and present teachings that are, I think, Jack Kornfeld and other insight meditation teachers are very good example in that, having gone to a place and had an experience of the teaching and then arriving back here, they're very free to present it in any format whatsoever. When teachers come here, what happens is that they're trying to present the teaching in the way they know how in this situation. So the way things unfold is quite a bit different. And when Suzuki Roshi came here, you know, he tried to teach us what he knew in the way he knew how to do it. At the same time, he tried to and was somewhat successful in learning how to speak in plain English about the teaching. After we had established a Zen center, a meditation center at Sasahara, and Suzuki Roshi invited another teacher from Japan to come, named Tatsugami Roshi, to teach us about how to do services and how to do certain kinds of ceremonies and that kind of thing. And I was exposed there at the time when he was there and learned some of these things and saw how he was trying to teach people. But what I remember was his insistence on the way to do very simple things. He had this way of teaching us how to do this gesture, which I want to share with you by way of an imitation of him. David Chadwick, who is a Zen Center student for a long time and who wrote a biography of Suzuki Roshi, he does this great imitation of Tatsugami Roshi teaching us how to do this. Tatsugami Roshi had a very heavy smoking habit, and he would the way he taught it would be, he would say, and he didn't speak English, you know, but a few words of English, and he would say, he would go, "No air." What he meant is that when you put your hands together like this, instead of doing it this way or this way, there's no air. And when you try to do this with no air, It's he didn't mean to kind of like that. He just meant you let your hands be together, completely together, without straining your shoulders or your back or anything. Just like that. It's a gesture of really great care and intimacy. And so this is also, I find, a wonderful metaphor for how I practice Zen, which is that there's no air between me and my immediate experience. And so in doing this doesn't really involve any thinking about it. Or, you know, we say this really doesn't have any meaning. And, of course, when you do something like this, some meaning might emerge. When I first came to practice at Zen Center and we would sit, and then we would do a kind of service where we would do bowing and chanting, and I always thought this was kind of weird, and the teacher where I was, Mel Weitzman, would say, don't worry about it, just do it. And at some point I realized that without thinking about it, without considering what the meaning of all this was, some meaning would emerge. And I think that happens very naturally. And it's not always a meaning that you like, of course. I think that doing certain practices will evoke meanings for you or anyone or others who that are, you know, maybe uncomfortable. In a way, not even the meaning that may emerge in this gesture, that's not really even the meaning. That just happens to be the meaning that emerged in that moment. In another moment, in another year, or another time and place, some other meaning might emerge, and that's the meaning that occurs in that moment. So we try to refrain from sticking to some feeling we might have about doing a particular practice, sitting or doing a service or bowing or something like that, or putting on these clothes. Another way I've been thinking about, or a kind of a different metaphor for this type of thing, that you, something you do in a particular way as part of your meditation practice, is to consider it as, and I think this is, I find this very useful, is to consider it as yoga, in the sense that yoga meaning yoking of body and mind and heart. And I want to say that I think that Jack Kornfeld has made an enormous contribution to the Buddhist way of speaking about things by bringing in the word heart to our vocabulary. You may take all this for granted, but in my experience, there hasn't been a way of acknowledging the sort of unpredictable, wild, and you know, kind of that aspect of our nature which is uncontrollable and arises spontaneously. And I think that including, you know, we talk about often about body and mind, but I think to me including heart in that as a triad is a way of acknowledging that our experience is really varied and in some ways cannot be categorized. So, considering something that might appear as ritual, alternatively as yoga, is this way of, it's kind of like Tathagami Rinpoche's teaching of no air, which is no separation of yourself from this act, just a complete and sincere gesture and without any gap. As you know, at Zen Center, we place a lot of emphasis on upright sitting, and whether you're sitting in a chair or sitting on a cushion or even lying down, this is sort of the, there's a kind of consideration of the practice as yoga in the sense that there's this, how you do things is sort of considered to be a kind of, it's open to the best way of doing something, the best way of doing a yoga posture or something like that is kind of a, you know, a legitimate question, a legitimate discussion. You know, it's like, well, how do you do this, you know? At Zen Center, of course, in our sitting practice, we give instructions, you know, to newcomers, and it's, you know, it's relatively detailed and terms of posture and breath and how we approach things. I had an experience at Tassajara some years ago where I was there for the summer, and for some reason, as it turned out, I gave this sort of introductory instructions in sitting every single day. And I got quite used to this, and after doing this for a while, I was sitting very peacefully and alertly with a number of people after doing at the end of this, and I thought to myself, "Gee, this is pretty good. I should try this myself." And I just to make a point that you know, even when you give careful instruction with yoga practice, these are only suggestions about how you enter into intimacy. And, you know, upon hearing my own suggestions day after day after day, I kind of sort of like, oh, yeah, that's it. Part of the problem with the kinds of the sort of detailed format of practice that we have at Zen Center would be that, you know, you can approach it as ritual, as something you're going to do next or something like that, and as opposed to yoga, in which is a fully entering into it with your body and heart and mind in that moment. And I think with any, I just want to backtrack a little bit to say that approaching, you know, practices like this as yoga and entering into them intimately is also, there's something interesting happens when we do it together, in that it's a it creates another kind of intimacy. And informs our own approach, our own personal approach to meditation. Now, of course, it seems like a sort of strange way to come to the end of this, although I don't know that I'm at the end. There's a, you know, with any approach to meditation, there's a kind of shadow side. And with Zen, you know, it's there's a bunch of different problems that come up, you know, that most commonly there's there can be this kind of groupthink about how we're doing something special, which, you know, will be tend to reinforced if, in fact, there's a kind of more set format for how you do things. Or there can be this within the context of your friends who meditate together, there can be kind of a competitive attitude. Or it can be something as simple as, well, I'm really doing something here. But, you know, these problems and other problems that might come up in different situations are really kind of unavoidable, and yet they're always something you can recover from. One of the universal aspects of meditation practice is that we are paying attention and paying attention. Then our mind wanders and we get involved in all sorts of matters. And then somehow we remember that we intended to pay attention, and we come back to paying attention. There's a great story. I don't know the names of these people involved, but it's about how a rather prominent citizen, this is a story about Japan, prominent citizen came to the Zen master and said, I want you to, you know, make a scroll for me. This particular Zen master was very well known for calligraphy. And so he took the scroll and he wrote character for intention, handed it over, and attention. And this patron said, oh, well, can't you write something, you know, some interesting poem, you know? You write something, and you took the scroll back and wrote again, attention. And give it back to him, and the guy says, well, please, you know, I really just wanted something, you know, something poetic, and took the scroll back and wrote attention. And this was his teaching, and it's very simple that, you know, what it really comes down to is coming back again and again, paying attention. I forgot to ask you whether I should leave time for people to bring up matters of discussion, but there seems to be time for that now, and I'd be happy if anyone has anything to say. Or if that, I don't know whether you're used to that or not. Yes.
And your Zen teacher once mentioned that in Zen we're not supposed to pay attention to emotions.
Oh, someone said that? Oh, okay. Well, my only comment is that I don't know what he's talking about because, you know, whatever you, I would say that that one of the problems with the sort of Zen metaphor is that it points to not, you know, it's like emotions arise and we are know they're there and we pay attention. And then, of course, there's a question, are we going for the ride or are we just paying attention? And so what this, this metaphor, this suggestion that you heard, I take that as, well, don't get on the train. And in fact, my own take on the approach is that even paying attention in the sense of watching things come and go as though I were a spectator is too much distance. In that that emotion arises and is a fact and a element of consciousness now. There's nothing else. There's nobody back there to watch. It's just emotion. The point you raised, I think, is important because there's a strand of thinking, in Buddhism, or at least the way we hear it in America, of this idea of detachment or non-attachment or not being involved or pushed around by emotions or thoughts or that kind of thing. And maybe that's okay, but it's not, but it also tends to be a suggestion of separation, which I think is kind of an artificial. It's not intimate. It doesn't take you towards intimacy with that very experience, whatever it might be. So I think what we're talking about is really kind of it's part of the evolution of how we understand meditation practice, which will take a long time. Yes.
Could you say a little something about how the Zen practice is different, or from your perspective from insight meditation?
Well, I hesitate to say very much. She asked me if I could say something about how I understand Zen practice in contrast to insight meditation practice. I asked Gil about this. And he says, well, I don't really like to compare them. And if he doesn't like to compare them... Being someone who has extensive experience in both traditions, I don't know how to compare them, because I have a little bit of experience, with the insight meditation approach, very little, and to me, entering into that really works. And this, what I, in the Zen approach that I understand, the way I understand it, really works. And I don't really, I don't know how to say anything that I think wouldn't be sort of off the point. I wish I could.
Well, maybe my question was really more to understand a little bit more about how the Zen practice works.
Uh-huh. Well, I'm going to find myself reiterating things that I said, but I will. In that the approach to sitting and is to well, maybe imagine yourself sitting and not naming, not noting, refraining from a conscious mental activity. Noting, but in fact, mental activity is taking place. Sounds, physical experiences, physical sensations, emotions, all these things are happening. And yet, you're just going to be there for it. Yes?
You've used the word intimate a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not a word that we use a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Would you say a little more about it?
I guess we don't use it a lot either. I guess I use it. But it means coming closer, coming, touching something, just coming closer with each breath, and not not trying to get a, you know, not reaching out to get a hold and not pushing away, just sort of getting comfortable with just the way things are. And sometimes that's kind of hard. If you're upset and you're, for instance, if you're upset and you're trying to sit, just getting, being there with your upsetness, that uncomfortable feeling, is a little difficult, but it's I was having this experience in a sitting, in a one-day sitting that the other week, and where I'd been, I'd had a terrible night's sleep, you know, the teenagers in and out of the house, and the, I don't know, just, it was just, you know, I got up and I went to the Zen Center, and I thought, oh, I plan to do this, so I'll do it, you know, and I thought this was going to be really unpleasant. You know, how am I going to even stay awake for this? And I found that the difficulty of sitting and the, you know, not somehow just being awake and being with this, whatever it was, carried me through it. And I thought, wow, this is, how could I have forgotten how this is, that in my everyday life, you know, something goes on. If I can just be awake for it, and as fully awake as I can be, and not kind of partially in that dream that we always go to, that dream of who I am or what I'm trying to do here or something, just being awake and being close to it. That's about all I can say right now. Yeah.
A companion practice to insight.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
How is that influenced or expressed in Zen?
Well, that's an interesting question. We recite the Metta Sutta several times a week in our morning service. And it's not something that we did even 10 years ago, 12 years ago. But it's a side of that acknowledging heart, which I think is really an important part of our practice at this point. I don't know how to explain it. but it's a there's a Japanese word for mind, shin, and Suzuki Roshi called shin, and it's usually translated as mind. But Suzuki Roshi at one point said, well, really, what it means is heart mind. And so for me, well, the intimacy of practicing with a group of people and taking care of your relationships with them and just taking care of the meditation center and all the work that goes into that really involves you with other people in this way, which raises that question, how can I be with people who I wouldn't normally choose to be with necessarily, that who just happen to be here and are interested and love this thing that we do together. It's an aspect of practice which is now growing in the in what I understand, what I experience as a Zen tradition in here in the Bay Area. And I think, in fact, that it is informed and is prompted in a way by, you know, tradition you're involved in here. That it's this is part of the sort of creative cross-fertilization of the different Buddhist traditions in the Bay Area. And I went to India some years ago at the invitation of a abbot of a Tibetan monastery to teach the monks how to bake bread. And and it was a very interesting trip because, you know, there was this kind of different levels of the project going on, sort of, you know, Buddhist pilgrimage and, you know, a project about how to teach people who didn't speak my language about something technical like that and in a part of the world where everything is different. But one of the amazing experiences there was to be in this situation where the whole, it's like their whole Buddhist world was there. There was the lay community and the monks and, you know, however it was formed and configured, it was a whole thing. And you felt like, oh, this is the whole thing. And it was incredibly inspiring. And in that way, when I came back, I felt like, oh, yeah, we have these pieces, you know. And I felt like this heart piece had not really found its way from Japan necessarily. You know, people I know who have practiced in Japan say, oh yeah, it's all there, and you know, it's just this different way that it fits together there. And so I guess what I'm talking about is this kind of process which I see going on. And I experience it in my own practice, and also I kind of see it happening in the various contexts in which meditation practice occurs in the Bay Area. Yes?
So this metta factor that's going into the Zen practice in the Bay Area, you are saying that there is something that corresponds to that in the practice in Japan, or?
Well, you know, I think that people engaged in meditation embody all of human experience, and that when someone comes from another country to bring something like this, to a new culture. You know, people are going to react in different ways. People are going to pick up on it. I think the way in which Zen came to America was also informed by the literature which was available at the time. So people responded to teachers within a certain context. And for instance, once a month we do a ceremony where we it's a kind of confession ceremony, and we acknowledge our shortcomings, and we acknowledge the Buddha, and we acknowledge the fact that we are going to try and continue to do what we can. And that is a kind of, for me, that's always been kind of a heart-opening event. How these things happen and how they grow is kind of a mystery. And I think it remains that way. I think we've run out of time. I'd like to thank you very much for your attention. And it was really wonderful to come here. And I hope I get to see some of you some other time. Thank you very much.